Ministers, wise ministers, know that no matter what they preach, their words may not be perceived the way they intend them. My old minister at an Episcopal church years ago talks about the day he preached on Corinthians 13. You know that passage? Love is patient, love is kind, love is not envious, love is not prideful. Of these things, the greatest is love. And he was very disappointed with it. He thought it was saccharine, was the word that he said. It was sticky sweet, and it was boring as a result. It was just a bunch of platitudes, if you will, and he was quite disappointed with it. And so as he was standing at the back of the sanctuary at the end of the service, people went by and they very politely said, "Nice sermon, Reverend, nice sermon, Reverend." But clearly he had not impressed them, except for one woman. And as she went by, this older lady shook his hand, slapped him on the back, and said, "Way to give him hell, Reverend." So, in this story, we see Jesus coming up against two things he's never seen before. First, he's asked to raise someone from the dead. Up until this point, in all of the Gospels, he has not been asked to do that. And we also see this interesting story of this woman who touches the hem of his garment. She doesn't ask him to do anything. She simply touches the hem of his garment and is healed. And I wonder about this. When Jesus was asked to come and help this little girl, you know, depending on which gospel you read, in some of them she's already dead when he's asked. In this one, she's on death's door, but before he can get there, the news comes that it's too late. And I wonder, when they first ask him to do this, he says nothing. Oftentimes when people come to him and say, "Would you heal me? I'm blind, I have leprosy," whatever, he responds. But in this one, someone comes up and says, "This little girl is on death's door, will you come?" And he says nothing. He simply gets up and starts heading that direction. And I wonder in that moment what he was thinking. Was he nervous? I mean, up until this point, he'd cleansed some lepers, he'd healed some blind people, he had, you know, exorcised some demons, he'd done a lot of talking, he'd given the Beatitudes, you know, up on the mountain, oh, that was pretty great. He'd talked a lot of parables, he'd gone up against some Pharisees and had some arguments with them, but no one had asked him to take a child that had died and fix that. So when they ask him that, can you imagine? I mean, we know he was Jesus. We know he had some mad skills, but do you think maybe this, he might have been a little worried? I think he might have been a little worried. Maybe this is too big for me. And that's why he was so silent. So, especially because everyone was with him. He was not privately by himself. Like when the woman at the well comes to him, you know, it's just the two of them. They just have a moment to talk. But in this particular case, he's surrounded by crowds and all of his disciples are with him. When he is walking towards that house, step after step, when he gets the news, everybody is following him. Can you imagine the pressure? Have you ever experienced anything like that where someone asks you to do something that is so huge, when you see a problem that is so insurmountable, and everybody's looking at you expecting you to do something about it? Jesus' silence speaks volumes. So, at one point when I was doing my field education, I was at a Methodist church, and I gave my first sermon ever, right? And it was a big deal, because when I went to that church, I was not aware that two of my former teachers at my middle school and high school attended. Yeah, yeah. And when they heard that I was there, I had been, you know, serving for about a month before I gave my first sermon, they put the word out. They called every other teacher from the Albany School District and let them know, "Remember Tracy? Remember Tracy? Class of 20 years ago? She's preaching her first sermon at this church." So there were like five of them that day. My old history teacher from high school, my middle school teacher, my seventh grade teacher, were all there in attendance. Well, some of them had brought their kids. It was a big deal. And so, you know, I gave my sermon. And afterwards, you know, because I was in field education, I had to give out a little slip of paper that was sort of like a little feedback form. Did you, you know, what was the main point of the sermon was the question. Did she speak slowly and clearly so that you could hear her? And do you have any other comments? And one of the forms that I got back, I still have it. It said, it's anonymous. It said, "Hey, Tracy, if this preaching gig doesn't end up working out for you, you should seriously consider a career in stand-up comedy." There is never, you know, in that moment with all that pressure, I had no idea that it might be perceived that way. And then I still have that. And to this day, I wonder, was that a compliment? Or was that like a dig? I don't know, but I'm keeping it just in case. If this gig doesn't end up working out, you guys might see me on Letterman. So I also remember talking to a colleague. She worked for the Metropolitan Community Church, which is a church that is especially open and welcoming towards gays. You often find them in urban areas like San Francisco. And this particular minister worked in San Francisco, and she gave a sermon one Sunday that she was very disappointed in. She said she had worked on it, but it was just fell flat. You know, it was just boring. And that Sunday, she's standing at the back of the sanctuary, and people are doing the standard. You know, it's like when people write "Have a great summer" in your yearbook. That's all they say: "Have a great summer." It's because they don't know what else to say. There's nothing else to say. Same thing when people leave and say, "Oh, nice sermon, nice sermon, nice sermon." We go, "Oh man," right? So everybody's saying "nice sermon, nice sermon," and the minister is standing there, and a person who was there in the sanctuary, she did not realize there was a newcomer there that day, is on his way out and says, "Today I was driving to the Golden Gate Bridge to throw myself off of it. And instead, I pulled into your church and sat through the worship service. And your sermon spoke to me. And it told me everything I needed to hear. And I don't feel sad anymore. And it's changed my world perspective. And I don't want to kill myself. And I'm so grateful for your words." There is no way she could have anticipated the impact that she had on another person. So we get to this story where Jesus is just walking along. He is in his own world. He is heading towards a very, very sad scene, surrounded by people who are staring at him with extremely high expectations. And at a certain point, a woman who has been bleeding for 12 years, and she's gone to doctors, and every time she goes to a doctor, it just gets worse. She says to herself, silently, "If I could just reach out and just touch, not even his body, just a little piece of his clothing." Some people think maybe it was his little apron with the fringe that you sometimes see on Orthodox Jews, that little piece of fabric. Maybe she was touching that fringe. Maybe she was just kind of grabbing the back of his robe. And all of a sudden, she's healed. And he didn't know that it was going to happen, and he doesn't know that it happened. It's actually a tremendous amount of biblical real estate. There's four whole lines that describe Jesus' confusion. He felt power leaving his body, this sort of energy transfer, and was surprised by it. And so he looks around and says, "Who touched me?" Which is weird because she didn't touch him, she touched his clothing. You see, he got that wrong. And he turns around and says, "Who touched me?" And his disciples are like, "Are you kidding me? There's so many people here. How could you even ask that? Everybody is touching you. There's so many people. You'll never figure out who touched you. How could you even ask that question?" That's a lot of confusion. And all of a sudden, she finally kind of comes forth and says, it was me. You know, it's okay. It was me. Here's what happened." And she tells him what happened. Now, this is an extraordinary passage because we get to see Jesus caught off guard. We get to see him a little confused. We get to see him not completely in control of everything in his environment, all of his thoughts, all of his words, all of his actions, because normally we see him very composed. Nothing phases him. But in this particular passage, he's thrown off guard in a couple of ways. He responds in silence to this request, and he responds in confusion to someone who is healed when he was not the agent of that. He was not being the proactive one. And that gives me great hope. Because if we are the body of Christ, that means that it's okay for us to be confused. It's okay for us to be a little surprised when people expect more of us than we think we are capable of. And it also means that very often our tiny act of kindness, whether we realize it or not, just being our best selves, even when we're not completely together, can still have a positive impact on other people that we may never even be aware of. I've been thinking a lot lately about the long-term effects of how we behave in this world and how we move through this world. Several weeks ago, the Reverend Dr. Vanessa Hawkins came to our Bible study class and talked about what she had discovered as the roots of black-white racism in this world. Now, I had been trying to figure out where it started. And I had tracked it as far back as the 300 AD, when Constantine, the head of the Roman Empire, made Christianity the national religion of the land, which meant that if you have a disconnect in the Bible, if in the scripture you have a warrior god, a vengeful god, a god of conquest, right next to a god of peace, a god of love, a god of turning the other cheek, a god of extreme charity, when you marry that to empire, which is all about power and conquest and money, no matter who you have to exploit, guess which one they're going to choose. And so that god was co-opted into the national religion, and as the Roman Empire and its model moved up through European monarchy, we had the seeds of what we saw when the pilgrims came to the United States and started believing in manifest destiny and plunking down churches. That's as far as I could trace it. But Reverend Vanessa Hawkins told me something very, very interesting. She said she started as an art class. She didn't even want to take this art class. She wanted to focus on pastoral care and race relations, but she had to complete an art requirement. So in her art requirement, she's decided she wanted to examine Roman art depicting Africans. So as you're looking around the Roman Empire, you would find like vases, you would find mosaics, you would find sculptures that were clearly depicting Africans. And she was showing us through the decades, in about the 100, 150 years before Christ, that depicts Africans as very noble. They are tall, they are statuesque, they are covered in jewelry and nice clothing with their fine weaponry, looking very regal, very, very noble, if you will, elegant. And you can see that all of a sudden, around 40 BC, that changes. And all of a sudden, all the artwork, you see like pygmies that are caricatures, you know, with huge heads and itty-bitty little bodies. They're like in swamps, like up to the waist in dirty water. They're fighting against beasts that look very strange, and it's clear that they're losing. Their temple is in the background. It's kind of fallen apart. And she started to ask, what happened? How did we go from regal, noble, respectful, you know, colleagues, another empire nearby, to ridiculous, small little people that are fighting, losing battles, and are dirty, and it was very dehumanizing artwork? And that became her question. What happened? What changed? And we still see the remnants of this today when we see, you know, a crime happens in a white person's picture in the newspaper. It's always their senior graduation portrait. You see the African-American that committed the same crime, and it's his mugshot, right? Very dehumanizing. This didn't just start here in America. We were standing on the shoulders of people who'd been doing it for a long time. I think America's particular society made its own special beast, but this goes back. So she started asking questions. What happened? What changed? And come to find out, have you all heard of Mark Antony and Cleopatra? Okay, so here's the thing. In the Roman Empire at that point, the emperor of the time died. So there was a power vacuum, and several different key players in the area were vying for that spot. And when all the dust settled, a man named Augustus, also called Octavius, found himself in power. He got to be Caesar of Rome. The other guys got to be, you know, sort of leaders of smaller areas. One of them was in charge of Egypt, which for all intents and purposes at that point was Africa. Egypt was an enormous state in Africa, an enormous nation. So he's in charge of Egypt. And in order to hold the peace, he married Octavius's sister. And his name was Marcus Antonius, Mark Antony. Right? So you have Caesar Augustus Octavius in charge of the Roman Empire. Right across the water, you have, representing the entire African continent, Mark Antony, who is married to Augustus's sister, who is the queen of Egypt now. Do you all get that? Okay. So everything is hunky-dory. Peace is in the land. Except that Cleopatra sashays by with all of her gorgeousness. And Mark Antony falls for her and starts cavorting around with her openly, making a fool of whose sister? The Emperor of Rome. Do you see that problem? So, Caesar Augustus declares war on all of Africa because his sister has been made a fool of. Because this guy is running around, cavorting with another woman openly, disrespecting his sister, who is the queen of Egypt. Mark Antony and Cleopatra flee. They run and eventually commit suicide. But that's not enough for the king of Rome. He continues his war in Africa. And it is around that time that all of the artwork in his realm changes. Now, if you've ever seen Roman artwork depicting the emperor, there was always the official bust, right? The official look of the emperor. And all of the towns would have the same bust in the town. Same thing with the other artwork. He could declare, I want this particular mural, I want this particular depiction of African people spread around. Now, if these two guys had just been guys, if Mark Antony and Caesar Augustus had just been two guys living in the same town and this happened, they might have gone down to the local bar, had a brawl, had a fist fight. One of them might even have killed the other, but it would have been over. But because they were in the power, positions of power, leading the most powerful empires in the world at that time on two different continents, where the people happened to have different color skin, it set in motion a series of events that brought us to where we are today. Do you see that? Because as he continued this campaign of dehumanizing the African people in his artwork and with his war, they are the enemy, they are less than, they are subhuman, and that continued for several hundred years. By the time Christianity was married to the Roman Empire and became the Roman Catholic Church, they were marrying into a system that already had it out for the African people. Do you see that? How many people have heard of this before? I had never heard of this before. This absolutely blew my mind. So then you fast forward 1700 years, and you get to the slavery times, and you get to the, you know, Europe colonizing, and here we are. Here we are. And as we look at what happened this week in Charleston, it's so easy for the papers to say, oh, this kid was mentally ill. No, this kid is the product of 2,000 years of grooming to believe what he kept saying as he was shooting was, you're trying to rape our women, and you must be stopped. Remember when a Caesar Augustus got so angry? Look at you cavorting around with women. You're just a gigantic sex machine. Can't even be controlled, messing everything up. It's the same thing. It's the same stereotype. It's the same stigma. It's the same dehumanizing language. It's the same demonization that allows us to believe in this country that it's okay to hurt people. Because if they're not human, you can do anything to them. And at the same time, we see the story of Moses. Moses led the people out of Egypt. He stood up for them. He fought for them. He walked with them in the desert, even though they were a cranky bunch, for 40 years. And he didn't get to cross the other side. He didn't get to go over the river into the promised land. He had to stay on the other side, and Joshua led the people. He had no idea that everything that he had done in his life would continue to bear fruit for thousands of years after the fact. Because it was his story that let the African Americans, the slaves, brought them hope and let them believe in a God that would liberate them, that would fight for them, and that wanted them to be free. And we are still seeing the fruits of that today as well. We sometimes have no idea how our actions, how our feelings may be perceived, or how they may move through the world or send out ripple effects, but they do have an effect. So we look at this story and we ask ourselves, how come Jesus didn't know that this woman was touching him? How come he didn't understand what had happened? We assume he would know everything. Well, there's this wonderful pattern we see in the Bible, and I've talked about it before. Whenever you see something three times, pay attention. The author is trying to tell you something. And we see those three times here in the story. First of all, it says she touched the hem of his garment. That's one. Then he turned around and says, "Who touched me?" That's two. And then the disciples say, "Why would you ask who touched you?" That's three. And then there's a fourth. This one's special. This one's a fourth because it's a story within a story. Then who does he reach out to touch? Who does he reach out to touch? The little girl. And raises her back from the dead. I think that in this story, we don't see Jesus reaching out to heal someone. We see someone else reaching out to heal him. Because when she reached out to touch him, she gave him faith in himself. She let him know it's not all about you. You don't have to, by your own sheer willpower, with the skills that you have, fix this whole situation. God will take care of it for you. All you have to do is be your best self, and God will do the rest. She reached out. And when he turns to her, once she explains what happened and says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well," that's ridiculous. He didn't do anything. Go in peace and be healed of your disease. She was already at peace, and her disease was already healed. I think the opposite is true. He was just, as people often do, going through the motions of saying that. Her faith made him well. He went in peace, and he went off to heal the daughter of her disease. She reached out and touched him and gave him faith in himself that he didn't have in that moment. And when we get to the daughter, how old was the daughter? 12 years old. How long had the woman been bleeding? 12 years. 12 years. Exactly. So, you know, we worry. We talk a lot about having faith in our own abilities. We have so little faith in our own abilities. We have no idea of our own abilities. I have seen so many examples of people being their best selves and later finding out the ripple effects of how they touched someone's life and how it created good in the world. Our own concept of our faith in ourselves is so flawed and so full of holes and so slanted in its perspective. Forget faith in ourselves. Faith in God is hard. Faith in God is hard, especially when times are tough, especially if you have been hemorrhaging for 12 years, especially if your child is on death's door. Faith in God is hard, but that's okay because this story tells us that it's okay to be scared. It's okay to be confused. It's okay not to understand everything because God has faith in us. God has faith in us because whatever we cannot do, God will take care of. Wherever we have a moment of pause, wherever we think we aren't enough, God will give us what we need. God has faith in our ability to effect good in this world, to heal what is broken, to heal what is sick, to make whole what has come apart, to make harmony out of discord. God has our faith, has faith in our ability to do that because God loves us, because God created us to be that. Can I get an amen to that?